What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. John, this is a really important one. And as somebody who worked in the education field for a couple of years, we were always worried about equity and excellence. How do we get more kids to do better so that that gap that we have in terms of the educational achievement is going to be bridged? And in the state that we live in, Connecticut, that has been a wide gaping hole. So we got some kids in New Canaan and Greenwich and other places in our state who are doing remarkably well. And these kids are destined for incredible things. And then we have kids who are locked away in a very tough environment in our inner cities, and they're just not achieving at the levels necessary to perform in a very advanced society like ours.
Plus, we keep throwing more and more money at the problem, and it doesn't seem to be fixing it. Though there are some bright spots. I think we have some public-private schools. I forget what they call them.
Charter,
yeah. Which are kind of making a difference for some kids,
but it's a small group, limited,
right?
Unfortunately.
Right.
And there are some good inner city schools. I mean, there are lots of tests. And that's the thing, John, that over the last 50 years, we've woken up to the problem. We've recognized it. We've said, this doesn't work as an industrial model anymore, where everybody just goes, gets ready for a factory life. Everything is just hunky-dory, and they all move along. We recognize that you need really, really different skills to achieve. And we've worked at it. We've tried lots of things over the last 50 years. But guess what? I saw a study, and John, you and I were really impressed with the gentleman we brought to this, Eric Hanushek, from the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And he got together with folks at the Harvard Program on Educational Policy and Governance, and they together... Now, these are very different institutions, one on the East Coast, more liberal, one on the West Coast, more conservative. And they came up with this rather dramatic conclusion that after all we've done and all the hope we've had that we could really bridge this gap in educational achievement, guess what? We haven't. And it's really, really sad. And I am shocked that this study did not get a lot more public attention.
You figure that, well, probably the education department in our state probably buried it somewhere.
No, or educators might have taken a hold of it, but I don't know that the public, yeah. And that's why we're bringing it to you, because, you know, we're not public intellectuals, John and I, but we're just curious. And so we bring you people who we think are really important so that you have some information here. And this goes back to March of 2019. So we are posting this in 2019. So this is a new study from two well-respected institutions. And when you look at it, you say to yourself, what's gone wrong here? And is there any reason for optimism after all the attempts that have been made to help all the kids achieve? And we're not able to do it. We're failing in some way. And so we wanted to talk to Eric Hanushek about this. And I think you're going to find this fascinating, somewhat discouraging, but let's find some silver linings. Let's find out what we can do. The most surprising thing, I'm going to be honest, John, to me in all of this, when we asked, well, what's going on? And what about teacher quality? And I really had never thought about it in this sense, but think about it this way, John, that we still have great people going into education. But I know there are some presidential candidates saying we need to give teachers more money. And it's got to go right into the classroom, not into administration, whatever it may be. And you see teachers all around the country now in red states and blue states, and they are screaming out saying we are done not getting compensated for what we do. We have the most important job, one could argue, in our society, and we're underpaid. And so I see there's one presidential candidate who is saying, I will take the federal role in education, enhance it, and give every teacher in America a raise of $13,000, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's the wrong approach because it really starts at home. I mean, you know, you really need, we need to somehow bring family back into this. They need to read to their kids. They need to show kids how important education is. I think if you don't get it there, then no matter what you do in the classroom, it's not going to make a difference.
Well, that's a really good point. But one of the things that is going on in the classroom, and I hadn't thought about this, John, maybe you hadn't either, but when you think about it, the bulk of the teachers are women. And when we were growing up, teaching, nursing, they were some of the few occupations available to women. Today, it's unyielding.
Right.
I mean, women can go into anything, which is so great. But when you look at this achievement gap, and I think you're right in part that the families have got to be brought into this in a meaningful way, and preschool education has got to be improved everywhere. But you look at it, think about this, and you talk about a yawning gap. Between the kids at the highest and lowest socioeconomic levels, the lowest are the equivalent of 3 to 4 years behind. Think about that, John.
It's scary.
How does a teacher even begin to address that if they're in a classroom where there are kids who are coming from different backgrounds? Well, let's talk to Eric Hanushek about this most important issue and this new study, Achievement Gap, Persistent and Resistant to Reform. You may only hear this on America Trends, but I'm so glad that we were able to bring this topic to you. With us on the line on America Trends is Eric Hanushek from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And they, along with Harvard University, have been studying what we have all looked at for many, many years, the achievement gap between those of means and those who are in lower socioeconomic status in America as it relates to education. And Eric, this has been such a gnawing problem for our society. And I know there have been many attempts to remedy it, whether it's integration, whether it's school funding formulas. I mean, how much have we attempted to do over the last 50 years?
Well, this was a key part of the war on poverty of Lyndon Johnson, starting in 1965. In 1965, he said, if we're going to deal with poverty, one of the things we have to deal with is the skills and human capital, and we have to make sure that poor kids are getting the education that will allow them to compete. Since 1980, really, in terms of the federal government spending, we've put in $500 billion in current dollars, and we've put in another $250 billion in the Head Start program for early childhood for 3- and 4-year-olds. And then states have done a lot. So I don't have a total number, but how should I put it? The technical term is big.
Absolutely. And I remember, because I was involved for a short time in education for the state commissioner here in the state of Connecticut, and I remember Terrell Bell, the first secretary of the Department of Education. So we really did make it a federal responsibility. With all that said, I remember the buzzword back in the early 1980s was equity and excellence, that we wanted to make it a fairer playing field. For example, here in our state, whether it was a rich community or a poor community, everybody got $250 per child. Then they came up with some very interesting formulas that looked at wealth, effort, and need in various communities. And so we've tried to do a lot of things to kind of balance the playing field, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Connecticut just recently finished a school finance court case trying to again readjust the $250 to something different and largely to ensure that everybody was spending more.
Absolutely. So money, people question whether that's been enough because basically your findings suggest that for nearly 50 years, student achievement has really failed in terms of the ability to close that gap between the haves and the have-nots. So that's not a very good sign if we've been at this for 50 years and unable really to have much of an impact.
Well, absolutely. That's our conclusion, is that we looked at the achievement of people in the 90th percentile of, and above of socioeconomic status, which is an index of parental education and items in the home, basically wealth or have the haves, versus those at the 10th percentile and below. And we were stunned to find that, in fact, this was a straight line, almost constant, and that nothing had been done, even though we had been trying for half a century to close these gaps.
And tell us, just for those who are really bugs about this, and I understand this, what kinds of measurements did you use? I know the National Assessment of Educational Progress, but somebody might be out there who really is deep into this in a granular sense, and they might want to know, what was the data that you used?
Well, we actually used four different achievement measures, and we chose these because, first, they're very well-respected and reputable surveys, and secondly, because they had information on progress over time. So we combined together what's called the long-term NAEP, or Long-Term National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a testing program for a random sample of the U.S. population starting in the early 1970s and going up till almost today. Then there's a second National Assessment of Educational Progress called the Main NAEP that gives you information on each state, but we just use the national information. And then we finally included two different international surveys that have followed U.S. kids for some time. One is TIMSS, which is the Trends in Math and Science Study, and the PISA, which is the Program for International Student Assessment. And all of these programs are designed to track on a consistent and intertemporally linked basis so that you can say if the score is higher this year than last year, you think kids know more.
So when we look at it, I mean, just to bottom line this for the moment, the achievement gap is as wide today as it was for children born in 1954. So that is something I want people to run around in their heads thinking about that. And the other factor in all of this, as I read through the data, is the fact it's not as if everybody's going up, but there's still the gap. It's not as if the wealthy kids are doing so much better, thus so are the poor kids, and they're all going up in relation to each other. It's that we're kind of static. Is that the case?
Well, absolutely. The fact that the difference in achievement is constant wouldn't be as bothersome if all boats were rising, if a rising tide pushed up all boats. When we looked in the same data at what has happened to achievement over time, what we see is that it looks like there are some gains of kids in middle school around age 13 or 14. But by the time they're age 17 and ready to go into careers or college, the achievement has been stagnant for the last quarter century. So nothing has happened in 25 years in terms of the preparation of kids when they leave secondary school.
What is happening at the high school level? I mean, it seemed to me in reading through all of your results that there was an admonition that the high school experience is one where kids are falling back.
Well, nobody really can describe what has happened between the scores for the middle school kids and those at high school. We think that something has to be done. We tend to lay most attention to the quality of teachers. And there's some evidence, frankly, that the quality of teachers may have declined some over time, just because teachers, which is largely a female occupation, have been, potential teachers have been going into other jobs. But additionally, for poor kids, we see that poor kids usually get the youngest, least experienced teachers. And that's probably more of a problem at high school, where content knowledge and ability to manage a classroom is so important.
I understand that premise that a lot of women now have fields opened up to them that were not opened up to them in the past, and therefore they have moved away if they're not getting compensated appropriately or if the job's too difficult. And believe me, teaching in my mind is a very difficult thing to do on a daily basis. So the question is, who has replaced these women in the classroom? I mean, the classrooms are still there. There's a teacher in front of it. There's a certification process going on in every state. And I know in our state, there are some alternative routes, but the routes are still pretty involved and pretty laid out as a path that you have to go through. So why is it that the men who are taking these jobs or the women who decide to go into education for whatever reasons, are they passing tests that are less rigorous? What do you see going on there?
Not sure if they're taking any tests, frankly. The scores, if you measured the achievement of the teachers, they've gone down some over time just because women are no longer just teachers and nurses, but in fact they're managers and doctors and lawyers.
Mm.
And that's detracted from the teaching profession. So that's been a part of it. But there's another issue that I guess we should talk about here. And we've seen the series of teacher strikes around the country, West Virginia and Arizona and
yeah.
Colorado, Oklahoma, Los Angeles, and so forth, and they seem to be picking up steam. They're right in one sense. We really do underpay our teachers. We underpay our teachers relative to jobs that a comparable person, in terms of their measured achievement and their experience, would get in other occupations. And we then, as a result, tend to get lower quality teachers than we might hope to. Now, the problem with all of these strikes, though, is that they have all been about, well, let's give 6 or 10% more salary increase to all the teachers. And if we pay all the teachers, including the very effective ones and the very ineffective ones, the same, we're unlikely to have any change in terms of performance. So what's been disappointing to me is not that we've had a national discussion of the pay of teachers. I think we need that. But what's been disappointing is that along with this discussion, there's been no discussion about tilting the scale toward the more effective teachers and away from the less effective teachers, which I think is ultimately what we have to do if we're going to get the gains and achievement that we want.
Interestingly, Eric, here in the state of Connecticut, just as my example or laboratory, I know the teacher evaluation was something really on the lips of a lot of folks in the legislature for a period of time. But it was really difficult to figure out, how do you do that adequately? In other words, when somebody's coming to you from another class and they may be far behind simply because they have had detriments in their own upbringing, they haven't had the stimulation, their parents haven't been together, a whole range of issues, and then they come into the classroom, they may be well behind what the norm says they should be doing in grade X, Y, or Z. What's the best way to measure the effectiveness of a teacher?
Well, what you bring out is absolutely correct, that you should not just pay attention to the overall achievement level of the kids in the class, because some kids come to class much better prepared than other kids, and you don't want to hold the teacher responsible for the prior preparation of kids in her class. We have a number of examples of how to develop teacher evaluation systems that I think are fair and accurate and reasonable. They would include looking, if you can, at the gains in achievement in a class. So if somebody comes into a class behind, you want to see how far did they progress during the year, not did they get up to some magical level of the average or anything, but how much did they progress. And using the gains in achievement over time takes care of most of the problems of kids coming with different preparation. You don't want to penalize the teacher for poor preparation, but you don't want to give full credit to the teacher who just gets some very smart kids in her class and doesn't do anything with them either. Many teachers don't have regular test information that can be used in that way, but we found that you can use regular observational protocols that have a systematic way of judging teacher quality that do quite a good job. So that some combination of actual supervisory ratings plus test scores is the way to do it.
And do we have a lot of that going on across the country? I mean, some might argue that in states that are dominated by the Democrats in particular, and they with a very close relationship with teachers' unions, might be pushed off of that because the unions often are not in favor of some of these measures. So do we find that teacher evaluation is taking place in many cases?
Well, what we find is that the vast majority of states now require, as a matter of state law or regulation, that student achievement and student growth is included in the teacher evaluation. What isn't required is that anybody pays attention to the evaluations, so that very few districts and states actually use that evaluation information for policy purposes, to pay and retain the best teachers and to provide support or find other jobs for the teachers that really are behind.
And in some of the urban districts where we have some of the issues related to our socioeconomic gap that we're talking about in terms of achievement, are they just worried that they want to have someone in front of the classroom? And if it gets too difficult or the evaluations become so much a part of the record and the retention and such that they may not even be able to have someone who meets the most minimum standards?
Well, there's a little bit of discussion of that, but we do have a few school districts that have actually developed really good evaluation systems and then start to use them for personnel purposes. The longest standing one is Washington, D.C., which is not a terribly good school system overall, but what they've shown is that you can improve, and you can improve by rewarding the really top teachers a lot and by actually firing the worst teachers or convincing the lowest teachers that they should go someplace else. And what we've seen is that student achievement in Washington has progressed over the 6 years that this has been into effect. A second system is Dallas, Texas, which doesn't have the same length of trial period, but is looking like it is going to be another system that improves by using good evaluation and using in personnel policies. But I'm giving you two districts out of 14,000. Unfortunately, we don't do that as often and as thoroughly as some of us think is appropriate.
Eric Hanushek is on with us from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And here on America Trends, we're talking about this Harvard-Stanford study finding that opportunity gaps between advantaged and disadvantaged students are the equivalent to 3 to 4 years of learning. Put that in perspective for us, Eric.
Well, this is 3 to 4 years of learning is going to translate into 30% differences in pay in the future throughout their career, regardless of what else happens. So what this really means is that we are handicapping a group of kids, and particularly a group of kids that come from poverty families. So we're going to put in place a system with limited intergenerational mobility because we don't provide the means for these kids from poor families to escape.
And as we're going forward into this technological era or greater technological advances, I mean, what can you surmise from that? I mean, without an education, I know that some have called education the last of the civil rights that we really need to focus on, many in the minority community thinking that this is really the laboratory where the future is going to be developed for so many of these kids. And as you say, if they're that far behind, but put that in perspective, given what we're looking at in terms of the jobs of the future?
Well, what we've seen with the march of the robots and artificial intelligence and so forth is that more and more sort of repetitive, simple jobs can be done better by machines. And what that then means is that people are going to have to be very adaptable to the jobs they take. Robots and artificial intelligence destroy a certain number of jobs, but they probably create an equal number of new jobs. But to get to those new jobs, people have to be able to adapt and to do different things than they've been doing. That's what education does, in my mind. It provides for adaptability of individuals and allows them to move on to some other place as their job is pushed aside by machines.
With all that we have done over this period in terms of preschool education, Head Start programs, magnet schools, various alternative schools, of course, the private charter model. I mean, has any of that been tested to see whether there's any one of these elements or any in combination that might have some impact on this gap that we're talking about?
Well, I come back to one simple answer, and that is that the effectiveness of teachers is what determines where kids will be. And it's not that teachers are responsible for this gap. The gap comes from family backgrounds, neighborhoods, and partly schools. But it is the case that an effective teacher can overcome the disadvantages that lots of poor kids come to school with. And so the one answer is to think about how do we encourage and incentivize the most effective teachers to be there and taking care of the poor kids that need the help. And we don't have plans like that. What we have are overall policies that are quite a bit removed from actually providing incentives for the strong teachers.
Now, we haven't talked about school desegregation over the last 50 years, and so much has gone into that concern that we had. But in your report, Black and White Achievement Gap, because we haven't talked about it in that sense, we've talked about it as a socioeconomic one, it did narrow in the early decades of the period under the study, but it has plateaued for the past quarter century. Can you help us frame that?
Oh, I'd be happy to. The real start of modern desegregation was the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education decision of the Supreme Court, which called for an end of de jure segregation in the South and then on to de facto segregation elsewhere. We had a very active period of school desegregation from the '60s, late '60s, into the '80s, and then starting in mid-'80s to later '80s, all of the energy toward new desegregation was taken away. The Supreme Court started the rule that if we really want to have equal society, everybody treated equally under the law, we couldn't single out blacks as getting better treatment than everybody else. And so the Supreme Court moved toward limiting the amount of actions we take for school desegregation, and that basically plateaued. And what I think the evidence, it's very casual and it wouldn't stand up to rigorous scientific study, but the patterns of the black-white achievement gap really parallel the active desegregation in schools and then the plateauing. And now we don't have much room or much possibilities of desegregation given the housing segregation we have and the residential location of different populations. So that's not something that's likely to help in the future very much, even though I think it's a very positive policy, and I wish it was consistent with other parts of our Constitution that we could get increased desegregation.
The issue of boys and girls, we've talked on this podcast about the fact that boys seem to be having more trouble academically than girls. You seeing any evidence of that in this study?
We didn't actually look at gender differences in this study. That is a constant feature now of education. Girls do so much better than boys in school in terms of achievement. They go to college more frequently. They complete college more frequently. And so there is a gender difference there, but we didn't look at that in this study. We just looked at the overall population.
Well, I want to thank you for coming by today. This study is just out. Would you give some credit to some of the others who were involved in this? I know it was a collaboration between Stanford and Harvard. I mean, how much better can that be bicoastally? So give us the others involved in this.
It's more than bicoastal. It's bicontinental.
All right. There you go.
My co-authors are Paul Peterson at Harvard University, Laura Talpe at Stanford University, and Ludger Wussmann at the University of Munich. And the study is has recently been published by Education Next, and so it's available online for anybody who wants to go to Education Next and find the full study.
Absolutely. I would really encourage them to do that. And I thank you. You've given us a great overview of it today here on America Trends. Eric Hanushek, thanks again for being part of our podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
You're listening to America Trends Podcast, and we're part of the Mental Health News Radio Network at mhnrnetwork.com.